This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Coaches, thanks you for jumping in to the Talking Split Podcast. We are back for week 3 of season 7. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Coordinator at Basketball Victoria. With me, the two high performance coaches for the men's programs. To my left, I have Nathan Cooper-Brown with the Countrymen. Welcome, Coops.
Good to be here, Rob.
And to my right, Darren Best, the high performance coach for the Metro Men. Welcome, Bestie.
Thanks, Rob.
We do appreciate all the interaction on social media, the likes, the shares, the retweets, the ratings and reviews you guys have been leaving. It is always fantastic. If they want any of us on the socials, Coops, what can I get you on Twitter?
Coach NCB.
Coach NCB. You can get me on at Rob Calder. Bestie, are you on Twitter?
No, I have a love-hate relationship with Twitter, so I don't have it anymore.
Oh, is that right? No burner accounts that just sort of sit in the background?
Like I'm hating it right now.
Oh, really? Is that you've been sniped by a couple of people or your sporting teams have not been going well enough and you just want to stay away from it?
Oh, it's a bit early for a story time, but I played for used to make us retweet their stuff on a contract. So,
yep. No more.
No more.
No, understandable. Very much.
You can email me.
Yeah. Darren.best@basketballvictoria.com.au as opposed to the old Ash Arnott, which would never reply. Bestie will get back to you very short and sharp. So what we are talking about today is the Australian Junior Championships or the AJCs. So we're at the point of the year where our under-20s, our under-18s and our under-16 competitions have been run. The under-14 club championships will be in the September school holidays. We're not touching on those today. What we are looking at is what the learnings we got from those tournaments are. And this is a really interesting point because we haven't had a lot of these tournaments over the last couple of years. Obviously, COVID's impacted the under-16s, which impacted on this year's under-18s because a lot of those kids are going to a tournament for the first time that haven't necessarily been to a Nationals before. 20s, whilst it's run the last couple of years, similar sort of deal. It's always a little bit different depending on how many teams go, who sends what. You know, 20s is that real weird hybrid of who's already at college, who's looking to put more time into their study and those types of things that can't necessarily commit. And then there's the NBL that sits over the top of that as well, where a lot of our kids can be involved in those types of situations. So we're going to look at a number of different areas. We are going to start off with the application process for our coaches, though. So by the time this podcast drops, applications will have been run and done. We'll have interviews, we'll say imminently, because I have no idea on the timing of these things, but it won't be too far away. So for coaches that have applied and are fortunate enough, I suppose, or qualified enough to get an interview in that process. Bestie, what are some of the things they should be looking to do as they come into that first interview process?
Well, I guess the first thing is Paulie, our administrator, he gives them a list of things that they're required to present on. And the first one is video. So they'll have a 2-minute window to present some video around style of play, systems of play, all those types of things. So that also comes in line with the knowledge of sports code. So to have that, have access to that, show that. Your preparation plan, what that looks like, you know, what's your schedule like. For our under-18s, obviously East Coast Challenge is back. Under-16s East Coast Challenge doesn't figure in selections, if that makes sense. And then obviously what your schedule would be going forward. And lastly, a depth chart of the athletes that you know in the program.
Yep. So how important is how you present that then, Coops?
Yeah, look, it's big. You know, you want your personality to come across. You want to be able to reflect who you are as a coach, as a person in that presentation. You know, you're taking athletes away for a week. You know, 16s in particular, you know, a lot of them are first nationals. So, you know, we want to know, you know, who that person is going to be, how they're going to conduct themselves. Importantly, how they're going to represent Victoria on the national stage. So, yeah, definitely having some authenticity in that and presenting it the right way. And then something I would just build on what Darren was saying, which is having some prior knowledge of nationals, of a campaign, of a tournament. You know, go and watch some film. You know, if you have been there before, can you draw on those experiences to give us the best sensation that that you know what you're doing?
Yeah, and that's not easy because you've got to sell yourself. And a lot of coaches aren't great at this. They don't love – actually, coaches do love talking about themselves, but they don't love necessarily selling themselves to people they don't potentially know. And there'll be obviously some questions that get asked that are just a little bit left of center or you may not have prepared for. How would you answer a question that you have zero preparation on?
Like the one you just gave me?
That one.
First of all, I would have a quick think about strengths that I possessed. So can I reshape the question to reflect the strengths that I already possess? Another one that I think is worthwhile is being a little bit vulnerable. So it's okay to say that I don't know, but can you demonstrate a curiosity and a work ethic to go and find out, to go and learn and potentially fill the gaps, you know, prior to starting?
Yep, makes sense. So, Bestie, we'll assume someone's missed out on a gig. What would your advice be to those coaches that potentially don't get what they've wanted? They've maybe applied for a head coach or an assistant coaching role and don't get it. What should they be looking to do after that?
Well, if it was on the Metro side, I would be, first of all, you can make some contact with me to find out why you didn't. But you need to approach that conversation with an understanding that this is a leap, and so from time to time, things don't go the way you think they will. And it's about reinvesting back into yourself and the program. There's no linear timeline to become a head coach or to become assistant coach. If you truly love the game and love developing players and our program, the Vic Metro or the Vic Country program, you should just want to be involved in any way you can. So it all comes back to the why. Like, why do you coach, as opposed to, you know, the little victories along the way or the accolades, I'm this coach, I'm that coach. It should be more about, I'm part of this program. So, and we've had that over the years, and no doubt there'll be some through this process that didn't get an interview that will fall away, and that's okay. But the ones that re-up, you know, that for me shows a bit of grit and, you know, desire to continue to build our program in themselves.
Yeah, and it is really reinvesting in themselves. Like, you don't want to just say, oh, look, I'm out, so I'm never going to do this again. You want to come back and try and find ways to be involved. If any coach reached out and said, look, I missed out on a position, is there any chance I can come in and watch an SDP session or be involved with this, or can I now have a look at things like Southern Cross or Country Metro Challenges? You're not going to say no. You're going to try and keep them involved as best they can, because part of that is passion. We want people that are passionate about this, that want to be involved in this space. But we also don't want the people that are just going to spit it because they've missed out once. I can't believe I've missed out, and they've given it to that person. It's not about the person that does get the job in those situations. It's about you. Like, it is genuinely about, are you the right fit? Maybe you're the better coach, but you're not the right fit. And that can happen a fair bit with our coaches. So in particular, the younger coaches, you know, that real misconception that, oh, if you're young, you're not going to get the job because you're young and you need more experience. And it's like, well, how do I get more experience if you're not going to give me the job? Like that real circular thing that continues on. Well, you can do a lot of volunteering space. And that's the SDP, the early mornings, the camps, those types of things, I think are a great space to go and learn a little bit more about how the program runs. And I know, Bestie, you mentioned it a couple of weeks ago as well. Know the age group. So find a way to be involved in that age group. So that might be going back to your VJBL club or your country association and saying, look, I want to apply for, say, an under-16s team in 2 years' time. Can I coach the under-14s team this year? Just so I see those players constantly, I know who they are, I know what they're going to be like, but you've also got a little bit of a feel for what the style is that's going to be coming through, because I think that's a really valuable part of it. That if you don't know the age group, you're going to be very hard-pressed to sell yourself as being able to coach at that level.
I think it's dangerous to get into the trap of comparing yourself to the person that got it all the time as well. Like, it's important to potentially identify some strengths of that person, but you need to work on yourself, not necessarily that, you know, I'm better than him because I beat him on a Friday night, or him or her, for example. So it's important to not fall into that trap of, you know, being singular with your evaluation as to why you did or didn't get it.
Yeah, I think in connection to that, there's a level of humility that's required for this role. And one of our values is honour. And remembering, you know, we probably are, you know, the most storied program in the nation, and the cavalcade of unbelievable athletes and coaches that we've produced along the way. And you think about former state coaches that have gone on to do special things, they paid their dues. They did get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. They did come and do SDP. They really did grind away to earn those spots and then to go on. And so, you know, we'd love to see the coaches coming through have that same work ethic, that same connection to our past, want to do the same things to you know, hopefully go on themselves.
Yep. So there are tons of things you can do to prep for these interviews. Obviously, the film is a big part of it. I know both you guys are really big on the film in particular. Know what you're talking to. Like, don't be almost surprised by a clip that appears in there. Watch it a couple of times over. Rehearse as you go into the room to know what you're talking about. Like, there are so many things. You can have someone prep you for an interview by just throwing some questions at you and going over how you would answer things, what you'd be looking at. You don't have to be an extrovert and a phenomenal presenter to be able to be capable in those roles. Like, it's just not realistic. Like, some coaches are fantastic salesmen. but maybe not great coaches. And it flips the other way too. So you've got to try just and be yourself. Just some. Just some. Hey, you have to be a good salesman as a coach. If you want someone to get down in stance on D, you have to sell that thing like this is the most important thing in their life at the moment. So you do have to be really mindful there as well as to how you come across and how you present that. I don't think it's a bad thing to throw some questions back. Like I think like similar to what we were talking about before, Coops, when it's like when you get a question without notice, you can buy yourself a couple of seconds by throwing a question back. Oh, do you mean with this? And that gives you a little bit of time to think through what you're going to do next. So it's so good luck to those coaches that are going to be interviewing in those processes. There are obviously not many jobs that are in that space, and they are highly coveted by a lot of people. So you do have to be very mindful that sometimes, although you might be a great candidate, you're just not the best candidate in that space. So that's not your fault or anything like that. That's just maybe someone better has applied. So good luck to all the coaches in that space. What we're not going to talk about today is the athlete selection. So that's obviously up for debate with everyone. We all know that everyone will have an opinion on athlete selection, and someone from the other side of town that's maybe seen one VJBL game at one stage, I can't believe that kid didn't get picked. And it's like, yeah, okay, that's one game that you've potentially seen that on versus a lot of years in the program. So we're not going to really go down the path too much of athlete selection today, other than we do know that state teams does tend to be a little bit of a short-term selection process. Like we've spoken before about STP being more for the long term, whereas the state team stuff is really for the short term. It's a short prep into a tournament and that's it. Whilst we do want those to be aligned with STP, and we would love it to a point where our state teams are made up purely of STP kids, because it means one, the talent ID has been right, which always helps. But two, those kids are getting the most reps and the most opportunities in that space. Doesn't always align. So we're not going to go down that path. But we are talking 20s, 18s and 16s. So you guys coached together at 20s. So we'll start off with that and knock that over. So you coached what is referred to as the 18? Do we still call
Navy.
It? Navy team?
Navy. NATO.
Changes every year, I feel like. But the Navy team. So Coops, you were head coach. Firstly, how was Bestie as an assistant? No, don't answer that. Like, don't do that. But what was the experience like for you as a head coach again?
Well, first off, Bestie was outstanding. And you know, the two head coaching experiences I've had with the Navy team to be assisted by firstly by Ash and then with Darren were just wonderful experiences from that part to be with guys who have great basketball minds, they're great people, you know, just allowed for a really good staff dynamic, which was excellent. Shout out to our other assistant Zach Malt, just so he didn't think that I forgot him. But It was an interesting tournament. Again, a different time of the year, different location, a lot more impact around team dynamics from obviously the beginning of senior basketball. In terms of our team, it always has its challenges in the fact that you know, there is a bit of an unspoken guideline around trying to get opportunities to athletes that potentially haven't played on a state team before. And that means that when you get to a nationals, it's their first nationals and you are really kind of working against the grain on even just small habits around tournament play and preparing bodies and those sorts of things. So that was that part. On a positive, you know, getting to work with some exciting athletes, you know, like John Furphy and Fraser Roxburgh, you know, guys that really committed to being up there, Zane Augusta, Darcy Jones, guys that bought into what we were trying to do, played hard, represented the state the right way, made it an enjoyable experience from that perspective.
How hard is it going into the tournament, and this is not to be said disrespectfully, how hard is it going in knowing that you don't have the main team? Like, does it change the goal? Like, how does it change the goalposts for you as a coach and your staff as well to know that, look, you know, we might have some chances to knock off some of the better teams, but over the course of 40-odd minutes, it's going to be tough?
Yeah, it is. I'll throw to Bessie because he's got a really good kind of metaphor around youth league. But just from my perspective, you know, this is an important tournament in the opportunity for both Darren and myself to impact the athletes, to try some things from a system and style of play standpoint. Obviously, if you marry up a little bit more with the first team coach, it makes things a little bit easier. I make life a little bit more difficult, just most people in the coaching community know that. But it has its challenges, that's for sure. But I'll throw it to Darren because he really picked up on it, this being his first experience.
Yeah, I think I described it as sort of being like a youth league coach. You know, at practice, if someone's down in the first team, your team gets pillaged, and even the reserves. You know, so we were in a situation, you know, 3-4 days out, we were unsure of what the makeup of our team was because of some injuries and illness in the first team. So it's a challenge, you roll with it. And like Coop said, the event is always enjoyable because it's a nationals. Having three double days for, you know, coming in, flying to Mackay, and then having three double days sort of exacerbated some of those things that Coop's pointed out with first time going to a tournament for some of these athletes. So they were, you could see it, you know, they were just exhausted mentally, physically, you know. But the pleasing thing was the comments that we got around how we were playing. And, you know, we were taking it to teams that were just falling off towards that, you know, last quarter. So on top of that, hearing some of those coaches, some coaches in our community that coach some of those kids now in youth league, how focused they've come back and some of their performances since coming back, they've realised, oh, wow, this is sort of what it's about, and I can have a chance here if I do this, this and this. And so that's pleasing, you know, sort of after the tournament.
Yep. Yeah. I think that's a really important part because the tournament itself is fun. Like, as we've all been to nationals, and it's enjoyable. Like, I don't think anyone's ever come back from nationals and said, yeah, that sucked, I really hated that. But you know, realistically, the tournament itself is enjoyable because you get to game coach. And that is probably the area for you guys, I suppose, in the roles that you sit in, where you don't get to do a great deal of game coaching. Like, you're all focused on skill development and systems and those types of things, but you don't get to do the actual game coaching. So the ability to go away with the under-20s is obviously a huge benefit. So for that tournament, on the men's side of the draw, Queensland won that. Very good Queensland team, coached by Joel Kalu as well, and did a great job. Like, I thought he coached that team really well. He had them playing the right way. Matt Nunn, coached the Victorian group, again, did a great job with those kids, got them to a point where they were literally possessions away from, you know, potentially winning the whole thing. So it's, you know, a great job from both those. On the women's side of the draw, our Victoria women were fantastic. Like, they dominated throughout that entire week and did a really good job. When we're looking at the tournament as a whole, what were some of the things that you found across the board? And I'm aware that you guys didn't get to see both sides of the draw necessarily because, as you said, three double days, you know, that's tough on prep and scout and all those types of things. But what were some of the things that you saw at the under-20s tournament that you found to be really effective on the offensive end?
It was a heavy ball screen tournament in terms of both early in the possession and late in the possession. Teams were eager to get into ball screen, to have that be their main influence on the offensive possession. Something else that we picked up on was some bigs. It was a big tournament in the fact that every team had at least one or two legitimate bigs. We saw teams that were happy to play through bigs, you know, down low or in the pinch post. So those were a couple of things that stood out to me.
And, you know, obviously this is always going to be the case as you get older, but having one or two legitimate guys that can just put it in the hole, you know, end of possession. We felt at times we'd done a great job defending, you know, the first 21 seconds of the shot clock, and then Proctor gets the ball and, you know what I mean? And this is why he's going to Duke and has already played for the Boomers. So playing against that level guys, you know, there's some people that are NBL DPs at that spot. And, you know, obviously Owen was that for the A team, if you want to call it that, and the Vic first team, and all through it, you know, Tui for ACT, you know, those guys would just get it done. And for us, that guy became John Furphy, and he really blossomed in that moment. And to see him be called up to play some games for the COE in the wildcard series is largely as a result of that. So yeah, that was really prudent. You know, every team had one, if not two or three of those guys. And, you know, I throw the name Proctor out there, but Kilminster at times for New South Wales would just let loose as well. So the individual ability of those players as they get a little bit older really, really came to the front.
Yeah, something else too that I think transferred across all three tournaments, but was definitely most prevalent at 20s too, was the physicality. On the ball, off the ball, you know, credit to the referees in aligning it closer with a FIBA international style of basketball. And that was something that also you could tell our guys weren't ready for, to be able to play that physically. You know, if your hands were out, you could use your body. You know, a lot of our guys, you know, putting the ball on the deck and immediately getting bumped off their driving line. So, you know, good double gaps or stampedes quickly turned into shallow drives. You know, feet aren't in the paint anymore. Now we're having to create a game with more dribble, which definitely hurt us if we couldn't get easier stuff, you know, perhaps in transition or early in the shot clock. So, you know, thinking about, you know, coaches out there that are trying to prepare athletes for nationals, the more you can get them used to that sort of level of physicality, the better chance they're going to have.
The 20s tournament as a whole, usually fairly early in the year, so February, but this is a little bit later this year. How did you go preparing, I don't want to say a group of kids that were thrown together, but I mean, Bestie made the point, and it's a very valid point, that if kids need to go up, that's where they take from to go up because there's potential injuries and those sort of things. Is it, like, how difficult is it to get any system or style or rules into your team?
Yeah, it is. It is difficult. You know, obviously have to lean on the ability of the group in terms of their IQ, their ability to retain information and transfer it to the floor. Myself, in my experiences, especially with the NBL One these last couple of years, with a low budget team and having to be creative, my investment in international trends and kind of deep diving into where, you know, we can potentially generate easier points offensively or take things away defensively was where I design my system of play. And I feel confident in that, hence why I didn't marry up with Matt as much. But Matt's really good. Him and I are close, and he's really supportive of that. And then I take that system to Darren, and I take it to Zach and say, okay, guys, these are the ideas that I have. What do you think? Darren's pretty good. He'll get the machete out and kind of, you know, slash it to pieces and say, this could work, this, you know, this may not. And we do our best to put it together. So, you know, two-man-sided fast break, trying to play with pace, maximize the first 4 to 6 seconds of the shot clock, you know, motion, read-based secondary, lot of off-ball movement, hopefully trying to get to a point when we get to the tournament that it is mainly read and react rather than play call, which makes us more creative, unpredictable, harder to scout. And then we Darren had a really nice idea on how to end the shot clock to again make us unpredictable and do something that maybe teams hadn't scouted before. I'll throw to him because I thought it was a really nice idea and again just gave us a different kind of feather to our cap.
Well, it kind of came about because it looked like, based on injuries, that we were going to lose our point guard. So obviously a lot of end of possession basketball is coming to ball screen, normally with your best playmaker, ball handler. So when we were staring down the barrel that we were potentially going to lose that player, which was Bailey Nunn, who ended up going up to the first team because of injuries, I decided that, you know, maybe we should have a look at something a little bit different and go into some off-ball screening last eight, which started with an elbow hit and sort of some split action or some slice action towards the basket. And it was fun to play around with, and we definitely got some scores from it. And, yeah, it just makes you a little bit more unpredictable and playing into the strengths a little bit more of the group that we had, because I felt that, you know, we had players potentially playing out of position and that good teams that we played against would just trap us if we were going to do that late clock. So we got the ball off the floor and tried to do it with the passing game at the end and had some success with it.
Yep. And I mean, how much of that success do you put down the fact that it was just different to what everyone else was doing? Because I think everyone prepares for a late on-ball 6-5-4-3, you know, an on-ball screen's coming. It's almost like taking that away from everyone can really mess with the defense. Like, is it just something you think they hadn't seen a lot of?
Yeah, and it goes back to what my point earlier around having that legitimate star or that could just make that play. You know, there's plenty of data out there around should you just continue to run your offense or should you pull it out and play that on ball. Quite often you'll end up with a poor quality shot, but it's all relevant to who's taking it. You know, so for us, we decided to keep the ball moving, get another side to our offense, get that away screen, and you know, Coops wanted to score on the first 4 or 6 seconds, so it didn't happen that much. But
you're
when
impatient,
it,
Coops, you shocked me.
But when it did happen, we had some success with it, and I'll certainly play around with it a little bit this year.
I see, it's good. So looking at the shooting percentages over the course of the week, so all these stats are courtesy of hoopsdb.net, so thank you very much, Duncan Berg, for that one. Across the tournament, field goal percentage at 39.8, so not awful. Like that's quite reasonable. Three-point percentage at 28.2, so that's a problem. And free throw percentage at 66% for the men's side. So on the women's side, 35.3 from the field, 27.4 from the three-point line, and 65.4 from the free throw line. I mean, there's a number of things that I think that can probably come into play here. One, the venue being hot can impact on that because you're going to fatigue a lot quicker, the shooting percentages go down, those types of things. As you mentioned before, three double days straight off, like that can absolutely have an impact. Things like on-ball screens. What else do you feel like had an impact on those numbers, Coops?
When you get to a tournament with that size and that caliber of athlete, you're now starting to close the gap a little on what we would refer to as the next level, you know, college programs, the NBL, maybe beyond. And what is an uncontested or an open shot is a lot different to what it may be in a VJBL, where you would have maybe 2 seconds to check your feet, take a check dribble. All of a sudden, that separation, the distance between shooter and defender becomes smaller, the time becomes less, and you could see that players that weren't comfortable being able to shoot at speed and shoot with a hand in their face or shoot with a lot of noise around them, their percentages dropped really, really quickly. The guys that, you know, like a Proctor or a Kilminster, guys that are used to, you know, flying off screens at pace, you know, being able to pull up quick off the bounce, you know, shoot over the top of the defenders, they really separated themselves. So, you know, this goes back to again, you know, the efforts and the work we're doing behind the scenes to help guys, you know, have their habits aligned with their goals. You know, you've got to be able to shoot it at speed. You know, Chris Goulding, Patty Mills, you know, guys that can fly around, stop on a dime and shoot it. 20s asks you to be able to do that. So if you want to be able to shoot at that level, you've got to be able to practice that way.
Yeah, we saw a lot of, particularly in our group, beautiful possessions that would just result in a missed layup because the person that came across late to contest it was 6'10". You know, and that was just the reality of it. But it still goes back to the physicality. You know, we saw our players be a little bit, you know, diminished through third and fourth quarters. And we, if you were to look at our box scores, we had good shooting percentages early on in the games, but as we continually got pounded and ground down by the physicality of it, our percentages started to dip.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. So it is a tough tournament, 20. So short prep, warmer weather, players serving a number of different masters, and that's not just with the two Vic teams, but that's also youth league programs, senior programs, you know, potentially NBL for those, WNBL for other athletes, COE athletes coming in. Like that's a tough gig. So good luck, anyone that coaches 20s, because you're going to have to do a lot of coaching on the run and trying to make it work in a very short amount of time. So it is a fun tournament to watch. Under-18s, in the Coops hometown of Ballarat, or one of Coops' hometowns of Ballarat, a great venue up there. So you can see Selkirk Stadium up there is phenomenal and a great way to host the Nationals, where you had everything all in the same place. KCC was there at the back end of the week. Just a really good tournament. So credit to Ballarat for putting that on. I'd happily go there every year, given the option. The under-18s tournament. So what were some of the things, Bestie? So I mean, you had your metro in into the gold medal game with that silver medal being the outcome. What were some of the things you noticed over the course of that week?
Transition basketball.
Yep.
You know, I don't have the exact numbers, but 70% plus, I would say, of scores was in transition. So it probably highlighted the need for us to work on some D-trans. So that's been a bit of a focus in our camps. But yeah, the amount of points that have been that were scored early in possession, so that was huge. The turnover rate on the men's side was probably a little bit higher than what I would like. But yeah, I think the biggest thing was seeing the variety of offenses ran by different states and programs. You know, it wasn't every state running similar stuff, and we've had conversations about this in the past, but legitimately I felt like different groups had their own identity, which was fun. It was just fun to watch.
Yep. So when you say transition being the main thing, is that because the defensive pressure was so high that caused turnovers, or was it because shot selection was maybe a little questionable and teams started to leak out, or were teams just a leader potentially just grabbing the ball out of the net and just going?
A bit of the latter, but I also think more skill has been developed in our big players that have the ability to get it off the glass, off a miss, and push early for those two or three dribbles and then the kick ahead. So I think a little bit of that and more coaches opening up to that style of play.
Yep. Coops, this is the first time a lot of these kids will have been to a Nationals because their 16 years have been cancelled. Did it look different to most other years' 18s from your end, or was it fairly similar still?
No, it did look different. It felt a lot less refined. A lot of live ball turnovers lead to easy transition baskets. Seeing there was way too much dribble, which was obviously from the COVID hangover. Yeah, everything was a check dribble. Everything was two or three dribbles to make a play. End of penetration execution was a real issue. You know, the ability, you know, like the numbers here around for the whole tournament, you know, the field goal percentage inside 8 feet was 51%. And if you're talking about only shooting 50% inside 8 feet, you know that's an issue. You know what I mean? You want to be shooting a lot, you know, a lot better at, you know, that close to the rim. You could just tell that guys hadn't been in that environment. They weren't used to the speed. They weren't used to the physicality. And it had a different feel to it.
With the under-18 tournament, there was obviously a little bit of a shadow hanging over the top of it in that Oz selections were up for grabs. It's another layer that coaches had to deal with at that tournament where they're not necessarily going just to try and win, which is obviously what everyone's, you know, main goal is, but they also have to then deal with players that have an eye on, but if I play well at this tournament, I'm going to put myself in line for an Oz gig down the road somewhere, which... there's part of me that says that's fantastic because you want them playing under that level of pressure and trying to go in mentally prepared to be able to potentially do both. How do you deal with athletes that are on that radar that, you know, you need to still play a smaller role at some times for team success?
Well, I tell you, credit to Tasmania because of the system that those guys have created, the style of play, the familiarity, the comfort around... knowing where to go and what to do. So it really has a read and react feel to it. But then a real understanding of, you know, who are our main guys, who are our role players, and how they effectively can create the best shot, you know, more often than not. And those guys got their three best players onto the Australian, you know, national team, onto the junior national team.
How hard a sell is that to coaches that go to AJC's Bestie that you're not necessarily, well, you should always have, look, let's try and win as many games as we possible and give ourselves a chance, but also showcasing the athletes to go on to the next levels?
Well, if you're coaching for Vic Metro, you've got to figure it out and do both.
Yep.
And that's just the reality of it. Mm. And this is why getting our positions are tough, right? Because there is an expectation that we perform at that level from a team base, but... also to be able to produce athletes to go to the next level. And for Trev this year, you know, obviously getting silver is great. I know he was a little disappointed with not winning the big last game, but the upshot of that is that we had four players ending up on the national team and also one getting a COE scholarship. So that for me is a overwhelmingly positive experience and success. And the message that I had to the athletes and the coaches was very simple. If we're playing at the back end of the tournament in the games that matter, you know, you will be exposed. You know, those coaches or selectors will be watching those games. They're the big games. And they want to see how you're going to perform in those big games. So team success ultimately will breed some individual success if you're playing at the back end of the tournament, was the message that we had. So, but yeah, this is why the Vic Metro job is tough, because you're expected to win, but you're also expected to get those players to the next level.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. So when we look down the shooting percentages for the men's program, field goal percentage at 41%. 3-point percentage at 28 and free throw percentage at 63.9. So very similar to the 20s. On the women's side, 36% from the field, 27% from the three and 67% from the foul line. So not brilliant numbers again. So when we look at the shooting from 18s and 20s in particular, I would suggest that our percentages are a fair bit lower. Like, I mean, the one that I think we can all link back to straight away is the foul shot. Like, that's unforgivable. Like, that should never be below 80 to 85%, if I'm being probably generous. I'd love it up at 90, obviously. But what's the issue? Like, why are we not able to stick a foul shot when we need to make a foul shot?
I mean, the whole thing, it's... I mean, how many times are we going to come in here on this podcast and say shooting's a master skill, you need to go and work on it?
I've not nearly got it as a drop for you, Coach. Yeah, thanks. Don't have to say it anymore.
Appreciate that. Yeah, it's the great equalizer. It's the point of difference. It's the modern game. If we're allowing athletes to move through our programs, not being able to shoot the ball, we're immediately doing them a disservice. It needs to be the focus. It should be at least 33% of your practice. It has to be the balance of form, game, and competitive. Foul shooting, to just come back to your question and just drilling down on that, it starts with routine. We had a high-performance coach, high-performance manager meeting with the rest of the country recently. It was a point of contention around what are we going to do with this issue. You know, obviously on the back of the Crocs in particular, who you know, had some key free throws, probably impact the success that team should have had. And, you know, we were all supporting them and would have loved to have seen them obviously go on and do a little bit better. So, yeah, what sort of routine do these guys have? You know, is it simple? Is it compact? Does it relax their traps? Does it get their eyes on the rim and shooting with rhythm? Or are they dribbling it 17 times, putting the ball around their back and overthinking it? You know, what's happening at the free throw line that we can go and help these guys and girls with to simplify and start making it more effective?
It's amusing you think 16 and 17-year-old kids overthink, Cooper. Like, it doesn't tend to happen a whole lot that I've seen. Bestie, is there anything you've sort of seen on that side that can make a difference with our athletes?
Well, with the free throw shooting, I think the biggest one for me is to try and encourage somebody to get there to rebound for you when you do it, even if it's in your backyard. Because if you're shooting by yourself, which I totally support, you know, you want to get out there and shoot. We've all been through it. Maybe your backyard hoop doesn't have a net, or your front yard hoop and the ball rolls down the street. That builds character. So we want to see that.
Amen. Amen.
However, with the foul shot, more often than not, you're getting two. You know, and I think being able to drill down on your routine is important, and simplify it is important. But I think in that HP meeting, I'm pretty sure that Peter said that there was a large number of N1 free throws missed. So there's something going on there mentally, being able to come back down maybe after a little bit of elation from completing a play with some contact and the bench is up and, you know, maybe it's a momentum swing, to being able to go and refocus to shoot free throws. So what we've been doing at some of our NPP sessions is finishing every score with a foul shot. So if it's a shooting drill, and even if it's a layup package or whatever it might be, and it's individual base where we're all competing, and it might be first to four, but you've got to make your foul shot. And if you miss your foul shot, your score goes to zero and you've got to keep going where everybody else goes. So that's one way that we're trying to impact it.
Yep. Yeah. I like that validation of the free throw at the end of a drill. Like, I think that's a great way to just reinforce. Yeah, it's nice that you've won, but you haven't. Like, you've got to now put yourself under a little bit of pressure and go and shoot it when there's something on the line.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, anytime you can manufacture a pressure environment that's hopefully going to marry up with some sort of pressure environment from a game, you're doing your players a service. I think also too, in you know, trying to give some practical help to coaches out there who are trying to get their athletes, you know, into these state teams and obviously help Victoria have success on the national stage, encourage your players to shoot the basketball. Can't emphasize that enough. If they're open, they got to let it fly. Now, if you've had some conversations around what's a good shot, what's not a good shot, you know, and that's framing when and where they're shooting it, fantastic. But if we continue to pass up open shots to drive back into a collapsed defense or take two or three dribbles to get to a different spot, we're going to continue to confuse, we're going to continue to devalue shooting, and we're going to see the numbers continue. So, yeah, I just please, coaches, get out there, help the athletes understand and value shooting, help them fall in love with the process of shooting, and then do your best to encourage them to shoot the ball in games.
Well, I think your creation of your shooting drills need to replicate the types of shots that your offensive system generates.
Mm.
You know, so there's no point practicing bulk baseline short corner twos if your offense doesn't generate that. So you need to think about when you're creating your shooting drills, you know, what type of shots your offense generates or ideally generates, and then you need to adjust your shooting drills accordingly.
Absolutely.
And it's funny you hit on that. Like, we've all been involved with the shuffle offense at various stages of our lives, and I know it was one thing I took away from Nick Abdusevich when he was coaching, is like the first drill we would do every training, first cutter drill, and like it was painful at times. It was like, oh, this again. But we were great off that. And it was something that we emphasized constantly. It was at tempo. It was always competitive against another group. It was never just a roll the ball out and shoot. It was always competitive shooting, which was fantastic. And, you know, it made a difference. Like, it may not be the most entertaining drill, I get it, but by the same token, it was game relative because we saw that shot. We ran it at tempo. But part of it as well was not just the score and the finish, but the pass to get to the scorer. Like, that was such a big part of it. So, yeah, coaches, if you are going to do anything, like Bestie's on the money there, and similar with Coops, with what he's talking about, like make them shoot the ball, but make them shoot the ball that they will shoot in a game, because that's where it really matters, I think. 18 is probably considered a little bit of the blue ribbon event, just purely because everyone's in town for that one. Like, all the best players tend to be playing at that one. But for mine, 16s is my favourite tournament. 16s is the one where you get to see kids for the first time go and represent their state and you know, their various areas of the country. I love it because you're kind of seeing kids break through for the first time. Like, you do have the occasional overdeveloped athlete that will come through that it's like, look, they're going to be a great 16s kid, but they may not translate to 18s or 20s. But by and large, you get your first taste of an AJC's. Bestie, we'll start with you on this one. What were some of the things you saw out of under 16s from the offensive end that you thought really worked well, or some things that you didn't think worked well?
Well, I'll answer it in two parts. So our Metro team, obviously, Scotty did a great job and his staff, and we won gold. But our shooting was phenomenal. You know, we had several players shooting the three ball from 45% and above. So that really impacted the way teams had to defend us. So really, really pleased with our shooting for our team, although when we look across the stats for the tournament, it probably doesn't translate. So for our group in particular, I was really pleased with our shot making. And I think the overall depth, which is, you know, a blueprint of the Metro teams. But once again, decision making across the board, premeditated moves, I felt. A lot of, you know, I haven't touched it for a little while. As soon as I get it, I'm putting my head down. And a lot of jumping to look, you know, as you move up levels, personally, I don't have a problem with jumping to pass. I've got a major problem with jumping to look, which, you know, there's a big difference in that. But a lot of jumping off one foot, I've got nowhere to go but into the defense or try and score over two or three people. There was a lot of that. A little bit of it in our program as well, but obviously our shooting, you know, players were probably a little bit more willing to throw it out if it was going to result in a made three, you know, which happened a lot with our Metro boys group. But this, for us, leads into why we've made some of the changes that we have for SDP. So we can get more kids on the floor together so we can work on some of these game reads, you know, decision making. You need bodies on the floor to be able to do that. So I think it all comes together. It's the movement off the ball to be a viable receiver if there is penetration or when there is penetration, and then the decision making for the driver when that does happen. But I think, you know, pretty typical for an under 16s, a few of our HP coaches sort of made the comment, because we hadn't had it for a little while, we forgot the difference from 20s and 18s to a 16s. And I know for me personally, I sort of felt like I was sitting there on the sidelines and you could see everything was going to happen before it happened, because it was quite slow compared to the other tournaments. But yeah, I think with my Metro hat on, really pleased at the shooting, really, really pleased with the shooting. But the decision-making in the tournament still needs to improve.
Yep. So, Coops, what do you got for me offensively? I know you prefer the offense to the defense.
Yeah. I have to piggyback on Darren's comment. I'm just trying to find the stats. I'll keep looking. But there was a dramatic increase in the field goal percentage from the previous 16s to this one, which is fantastic. So on the back of the discussion we obviously just had, to see that investment by this age group, by those coaches, was it was just so pleasing. Like, it was just, it had a different feel to it. You could see, you know, there was athletes shooting the ball with confidence, making consecutive shots. It was fun to watch. It opened the game up. The over dribble remains an issue. The limited possessions of, you know, guys catching it and moving it. You know, that real presence of mind to understand the best thing I can do right now is just to pass the ball on and keep the offense moving, again, was limited. Transition was probably not as effective as the 18s, especially in the ability to move the ball in those first 4 seconds. Saw a lot of passes tipped out of bounds or picked off. You know, those guards that could really move the ball that way could separate themselves. And then also too, ball security I found was a big one. And I think it ties into, you know, the end of penetration execution and the 2 feet, you know, play that Darren's talking about. But just an understanding of where to move the ball. You know, we've got a guy in our MPP, you know, Ben Waller, from out east, and his ability to punch the ball out with two hands away from the defense when he's coming downhill is a real elite skill. And the amount of times that players, both on the female and male side, you know, got into any sort of crowd, and that may be just trying to split a single gap or, you know, feet in the paint, playing against the collapse defense, and it's under 16, so everyone's going to collapse. The amount of stripped basketballs, tipped basketballs, balls knocked off feet out of bounds was really, really high, and disappointing, because you want to see those plays, you know, you want to see those plays come off and see the athletes experience success for, you know, perhaps making the right move or being able to turn the corner on a ball screen or whatever it may be. So definitely some areas that we need to invest in.
Yep.
And I know for the, on the boys' side, some size, legitimate size in the 16s. You know, there was discussions around Oz selections, obviously, and we can't go into detail with that yet. But the reality is, in the past, if there was size, pretty much they get a tick and they get to go to the camp. Whereas this camp, it was discussions because there was multiple players of size that we could say, all right, well, let's see who's really, you know, got the right stuff to go. So the size in the tournament was pleasing on the boys' side, yeah.
Yeah, no question. So I'll hit the elephant in the room. I got to watch a lot of this tournament purely because it was on YouTube and KO. So credit to BA for getting that done, because I wasn't making the trek to Warwick for this one. And I think everyone enjoys watching these tournaments when they go on. The defensive side of the ball, there was a lot of zone, is probably the greatest understatement we can make. Coops, give me your thoughts.
A lot of zone to hide the fact that 1v1 defense is still a concern, that players haven't quite mastered that ability to close out, contain, contest without fouling. A lot of zone to plug holes around understanding off-ball positioning and stay-go communication. So as soon as, you know, it was two or three splits, the zone came out. A lot of zone in sitting in a zone, so not using it as a change-up and trying to be junky and change the tempo. It was just, hey, let's go, let's run back to our Carnival 2-3, let's sit in that. We know it's 16s, you know, it's going to make life difficult on the opposition. A couple of teams there that decided to play zone for most of the tournament, but we would like to think that the responsibility around producing defenders and understanding how to be physical, elite, proactive defenders ties into what we're doing from a national standpoint, and we all need to adhere to that responsibility and invest in it. And I'd like to think that that's more important than winning medals.
Well, the reality is, Coops, as you know, you and I were both on the selection panel for the boys, and we were given a criteria, and one of them was ability to defend on the wing for that position. So some athletes, they didn't get a chance to do it in front of us.
Yeah.
And that's just the reality of it. Yeah, so we don't know if they can or can't.
And it is difficult from a team perspective too. Like, if, and no one is suggesting you can't play zone at these tournaments at all. And I know I come across regularly on this podcast as a hater of zones. I somewhat apologize, but not completely. But I think there's a big difference between using a zone as a change-up to try and disrupt, that have clearly got some rules in place, or that might be a trapping area, or we're going to deny ball reversal out of it, or we're going to double down from a certain area, versus we're just going to do it just to hope that they miss. And I think that's probably the difference between the two. And there was a lot of zone. And to be fair, I did see a lot of teams have to go to zone when their rotations got shorter, players got in foul trouble, injuries happened. So there were some absolute reasons behind some of them. But it is an area that if we're going to ask our coaches at the VJBL level, for example, to get our players in man and denial and being up and in, we probably have to show them what that looks like at the next level up so they can see where it applies and why it applies, I think, in that space too. So it is something that we have to be really conscious of when we go to these types of tournaments. It's not saying you can't use it, but just being mindful about when and where and how.
Nobody wants to see it being plain 1A.
And then the fact that now, and we know, and I've already had this discussion with a few people, that the under 16 campaign, I know for my group, going back to Perth in 2023, one of the things that we're going to have to work on straight away and invest more time in is zone offense, which is, there's a place for it, and the decision making and skill set is important, and yes, you can play zone at the next level and so on, but for under 16 athletes especially, that time could be spent better elsewhere.
100%. And in my review with Scotty, after the celebrations had died down, we caught up a couple of weeks after to do our formal review, which we all do, and that was the first thing off his tongue when I said, what would you do different with your prep? And this is a team that won the gold medal and had several players shooting the ball phenomenally, saying, oh, we have to spend more time on Zono, which is a problem.
That makes a lot of sense. So when we're looking at AJCs have been run and won and all that sort of stuff, does this give you a clearer picture on the differences in your roles in particular between country and metro and boys and girls? So you've probably gone in with some ideas of this already, but then you've come out of the tournament. Bestie, we'll start with you. What are the big differences you see between the programs?
The boys on the Metro program, their skill base is pretty good in this age group, definitely 16s based on what we talked about with the shooting percentages and those things. We need more game-based play to build that decision-making. So we need more numbers on the floor, which is why we've made some of the changes with SDP. Now, that can also help the girls so they can practice their skill within those environments. But for the boys, it's about the decision-making at the end of penetration. It's the understanding of who I'm playing with, what are my strengths, some self-awareness, as Coops likes to say. So I think that's the biggest thing on the Metro standpoint. And there'll be things that we'll be looking to address through our SDP program.
Yep. Coops, what about you guys?
Yeah, we had some really good discussions in Perth. Darren and I got to sit and watch a lot of basketball and and try and solve all the problems of the world in 8 days, and we got pretty close, which was nice. So I totally agree on where that the Metro group lies, and then in terms of us, really the biggest thing that stood out for me was toughness. And credit to the under 16 Country Vic girls, who you would say exceeded expectations probably. Credit to Matt and the staff and the girls for what they did. But they got there through toughness. They had a real grit about them. Their repeated efforts, they played hard, they tried to value the ball, they got the ball in the right people's hands, and that ended up as success. For us, we're coming along with size, which is fantastic. We're coming along with skill set, more so than I think we've ever seen in country, where it used to be more of a gritty football player type that made up predominantly most of the spots. But funny enough, it looks like the pendulum's kind of swung too far that way into size and skill, and the lack of toughness cost us. Lack of toughness to take care of the basketball, to be able to pivot and rip the ball and just get the ball to the next player. The end of penetration execution, being able to be way more effective in a crowd in just, using what we call a protection plan. I drive in and I see three bodies, in front of me. It's got to be a quick stop. It's got to be a pivot, and we got to play behind the path of the ball. You know, toughness in defense, toughness in rebounding. I think we only won the 3-point battle in one game throughout the week, which had, again, a big impact for us in terms of success, because I would have liked to have seen our boys, you know, probably finish a little bit higher, and I've got no problem saying that. I've had the conversation with the athletes and with the coaches. So it's interesting how you know, the difference between the men's programs in particular now have to be addressed, and you know, we have to be conscious of that, even, you know, within our one state mentality.
Yep. And it's interesting listening to both of you. The overarching theme, I think, from both is the decision making. Like, it's the, and so that relates back to our potentially our coaches that are at the VJBL level, Big V Youth League, those types of things. More decision making work done at our practice sessions, I think, is going to be really valuable, and that's both sides of it. So it's not just the offensive decision making; it's also the defense. Do I stay? Do I go? Can I keep this in front? Where's my push point? Am I influencing it one way or the other? Whatever your rules are is fine, but the more competitive decisions that our players have to make in short amounts of time, I think, is really valuable if they want to translate to the next level. Like, it's, we see it all the time that the players are that are phenomenal athletes, and we get this argument a lot from a lot of clubs as well. Oh, but they score 20 points every Friday night. It's like, yeah, we know. Like, we can see that they can score, but that doesn't always translate into the next level when they get there. They might score that because they're just bigger, stronger, faster. They don't necessarily get there because they've made a good decision to get to that point. And you guys both alluded to it in 20s. The physicality that comes into it, it's, you know, if you can't make a good decision, it doesn't matter. Like, you're just going to get planted by the time you get to the rim.
Yeah.
For the most part, I've always worked on probably about 25% of your production in a rep level will translate to AJCs. And I think shooting percentage is a big one. You know, obviously, we've seen it's affected with physicality and all that. But I'm less impressed with 20 points on 20 shots than I am 10 points on 5 shots.
Yeah.
You know, because that's all you're going to get at an AJC is, unless you are a Tristan Devers, you know, unless you are, you know, those higher end guys that have, you know, Oz stuff, you know, in their sights, you are not going to go there if you apply 7, 8, 9 and get 20 shots.
Mm.
It's just not going to happen. So it all becomes about your efficiency.
Yeah, it's such an important word, you know, especially when you're talking about, you know, national success and then going on to international basketball. And for all the coaches that are really invested in this, we just had 2 under-17 World Cups. And you're not going to get better data, you're not going to get better visual examples of the kind of skill set and ability to scan and make plays with a guy on your hip or a girl on your hip than those two tournaments. Josh Dent, obviously from New South Wales, who was a starting point guard for the Crocs. You know, if coaches haven't gone and watched his tournament, I highly recommend that. You know, that's someone that you can see, you know, making the kind of effective plays that we're going to need more of, both on the country and metro side as we start up this new national campaign for 2023.
Yep. So coaches, if you are still unsure about what you should be doing with your teams moving forward, please encourage you to get involved with the SDP and go and have a look at what some of the coaches are doing, which is obviously being drip fed down from you guys through to our hub leads and the like. It's get to a camp, get to a session where you can see a little bit of the content and what can relate to you and your coaching going back to your club and your team. That does wrap us up for today. Thank you guys for jumping in. I very much appreciate it. We can go and rehydrate for the next 4 hours to try and Jared Potter said he was coming back with drinks, but we haven't seen him since.
Nah, he's disappeared.
Since he bailed. But thank you, coaches, for jumping in, and we will catch you guys next week back on the podcast. Look. Tune in and join the tribe.